The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
I'll finish. Plenty of time for questions. Let's see if that plan works. Not all of my plans come to fruition. Some years ago, I read a book that my mother gave me, which I'm quite sad that I lost. I had an experience I had when I had a sixth sense, where I got confused momentarily between the reality of the fiction that I or the power of the fiction. So in the book that my mother gave me, it was a novel about people, some archaeologists in Jerusalem discovered disputable evidence, as it turned out, that Jesus had not risen from the dead, that there was a conspiracy, a well-intended conspiracy in this particular, but nonetheless, they found the body of Jesus and were able to prove it. And then they had some of the repercussions as news, you know, headed around the world. And I remember I had a moment of thinking, gosh, it's all rubbish. And then I thought, it's a book. And in the end, shows that the conspiracy, the discovery that the conspiracy was itself a conspiracy, so we all lived happily ever after. But it was just a reminder of the fact that, as most of you will probably be aware, that Christianity is at one level the most vulnerable, that is, it chooses to place itself one thing true. The whole thing falls apart. Let me read you from one of the earliest bits of Christian writing, from 1 Corinthians 15. I read this because this is probably the clearest statement of what is clear elsewhere in the teaching of Jesus. This is what it says here. If, you know, it's the if-then sort of logic. Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith in vain. Testify about God that he raised Christ. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, your faith is worthless. You are still in your sins. We are of all people most to be pitied. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead. So you can see the clear-headed logic. It's generally missing in much of the spiritual talk in our age, that basically if this event did not happen, Christianity is not just a fiction. At some level it's fraudulent, possibly deliberately, and it's probably a filthy lie would be the most sensible way to understand. So there's certain clearness about the early Christians that is sometimes lacking in 21st century, etc., spirituality. Now, part of the thing that helps us to see just how brutally clear things are that the Bible's talking about is the actual literal meaning of the words which we translate as the resurrection of the dead means the standing up of a corpse. So it's a very brutal picture. It's not a spiritual thing at all. It's essentially a physical thing. A corpse standing up is what the word resurrection of the dead means. So all the notion that you'll hear people say, sometimes even from Christian pulpits, that it's about the enduring power of the life of Jesus, the triumph of love over hate, of life over death, all that sort of stuff. Now, I always enjoy using legal terms here because I know I'm in danger of blowing my feet off, but I'll use it, but in a popular sense. I think anyone who hears this claim that Jesus walked out of the tomb, physically, at a prima facie level, that is a self-evident nonsense, isn't it? I mean, if you hear the story that someone was well and truly dead, torn apart dead, you know, nails, whips, spears type dead, and first response that the disciples had when they were that the body was missing and angels had met them, etc. In verse 11, these words seemed to them as an idle tale. The TNIV seemed to them as not And unable to turn up today. When you read books of people, followers, you see that the early Christians are well aware that we no, we're aware it's completely the one of and it's hard to believe. Good Ludwig come back to one of the world's leading scholars in the whole area of study of the evidence for the resurrection. I've heard him in Christians, but his area of study interesting body brought back it is very difficult to believe. Yeah, I want to mention a book an Orthodox Jewish man in a number of his expertise to look at the doctor he made Christians around the world somewhat happy was here is a man whose prejudice is not to believe it, whose prejudice you would think heads in the opposite direction. The evidence, his conclusion is, he says, I understand the resurrection of not an invention of the community of disciples, but as an and he will explain that he step will explain. I thought the most argument for not Christian, that's another issue. They read fresh idea. He's not mentioned that is not to say Slepid believes it, therefore we that's particular. I have conversations with members of my family sometimes. Evidence is so myth-like. Half any knowledge of I think what like Pinchas the Pete does, and there are I could mention 100 something years ago wrote a classic legal system on how you get so he was an Orthodox Jew, he was a sort of a liberal and good fun. Nervous when I hear friends people who've looked at it. I can't work out why some of my friends can't at least see that there is some real substance to this. A little bit like when I listened when I was a younger Christian saying, no one who's half informed about this could not believe it. I think all those sort of overstatements are overstatements. But there is some evidence that has convinced people from the very beginning, and let me touch on that briefly and have more time for questions if I'm brief. So the data. One of the things that's difficult for us to appreciate, historically unique thing that happened when Christianity burst into the first century world. This movement that came out of nowhere, grew slowly, but was irrepressible, full of joy, full of confidence. It had a very, quite revolutionary ethical system, very strange spirituality, no need of sacred places, buildings, churches, priests, etc. And its message was a message. Its message was fundamentally, we've seen the Lord. He is risen. How do we know? We've seen him. Resurrection has been the central message, the foundation, the enthusiasm. It is repulsive to the Greek and Roman world. The whole idea of and the soul continuing, but the idea of the body rising up and enduring was a thing that the whole Greek and Roman spiritual world found distasteful. Jews, it was a self-evident falsehood, because if there was a which most Jews believe but not all, it was at the end of history. The notion of the middle of history was not a good idea to make resurrection your central thing. Nobody liked it. So when Paul gets to Athens, as you'll know, and has a chance to preach in the center of the academic world, they're with him as he talks about God and creation and the nature of God, etc. As soon as he mentions resurrection, right? Because the idea of the standing up of a corpse as being either true or attractive was not. So the thing is to try and make sense of this very peculiar movement that in the end is the largest single movement in the history. Two things that when they sit down and write the accounts of what happened is that the body of Jesus is missing, and I think that's pretty much an incontrovertible historical fact. You can see the first mention of that in Luke at the very beginning there, at the top of the page. Dies on the Friday. The burial procedures are not finished because the Sabbath comes and the Jews have to rest on the Friday night. They turn up on the Sunday morning. On the first day of the week at early dawn, they went to the tomb, the they is the women it was speaking about at the end of chapter 23, taking the spices which they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not. So they thought they had an appointment with the body, but the body was missing. We know from the New Testament itself and from writing the New Testament that the standard sort of authoritative Jewish answer was, the body's missing because you guys stole it. The early Christians for about the first half of the Sunday were saying, the body's missing because you guys stole it. I think it's discussed in question time that the body of Jesus is clearly missing. Now, what we know is that the Christians are not stupid enough to say resurrection any more than you would. So, I can visit my father's body as such because he was burnt and buried under a rose bush. I can visit the rose bush and I put it somewhere in the system. If we had one of those family sepulchres, as our Italian neighbours have often had, if you buried someone and then came back and the body was gone, you don't go resurrection. You go, which filthy mongrel has been messing around with, you know, the sacred remains of people I loved? And that was happening at Gore Hill Cemetery some years ago. People were breaking in and stealing bones. Perplexed. Sorry, that verse isn't there, I don't think. I think it's verse 12. And he goes off, sees that the body's missing, and goes home perplexed. What does this mean? A significant number of reports, sometimes called independent reports, of people meeting the ex Jesus. 24, you heard one of them. And in order to prove that he's not a ghost, he invites them to touch him, and he eats in front of them, which is, as I think I've shared in the past, we know from the Jews from the first century writings, they believed in ghosts. The two things they knew about ghosts were, they don't eat and they can't be touched. So that's why I think that's why Jesus says, touch me, I'm not a ghost, I'm not a spirit, and you've got something, something to eat, and he eats. And there's a number of reports of Jesus appearing to people. Let me give you the atheist scholar. He says this, it may be taken as certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences to them. And he goes on. It's quite clear that that early Christians had these overwhelming experiences of the risen Christ. It's an atheist resurrection. He sees it as an hallucination. Yeah, which he's moved a little bit, and he's entitled to move in his explanation. Each time I've heard him speak, he spoke of it starting with Peter and then moving through the rest of the disciples. It's an hallucination, real, life-transforming, but it's fundamentally something that happens in the disciples, not to Jesus. And I think that's a helpful distinction when someone drew that to my attention. Is the resurrection something that happens in the disciples, or is it fundamentally something that happens in the disciples? One of the interesting things when you look at the various accounts in the four Gospels, and if you also chuck in, say, 1 Corinthians 15, but I'm happy to leave that out if you like, but I'll include it in this particular discussion. Jesus appears, and this is one of the reasons why people who study how hallucinations work think this is certainly an unusual set of hallucinations. One, it comes to those not expecting it and not looking for it. Normally hallucinations happen, they fulfill a longing or a desire, but they happen to individuals on their own. Happened to small groups, 7 at one point, 10 at another, 11 at another, and one time to a large group, which seems to be the group of 500 that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 15. That's in Matthew 28. It happens to women on their own, happens to men on their own, happens to two men as they're together. It happens to some of his enemies, which is often not realized. It happens in gardens, it happens in rooms, it happens beside the lake, it happens on hillsides, it happens on roads, and then it stops. And in some of them, he teaches them. Some of them, he says, touch me. Some of them, I think he teases them. It's a whole great diversity of appearances that he has. I personally, and this is another thing I've been discussing with my nephew who lives in Canada, I'm surprised at how people can read the Gospels and not notice how they are just not myth. In fact, frankly, I think Matthew was a goose the way he wrote some of his stuff down. I mean, to have it I mean that respectfully. Maybe we'll have a chat if we both arrive in heaven. But to have on the go to all the world, just to have a little comment, you know, that when they saw them, they were happy, but some of them doubted. I think, oh, thank you for that. Genius. To have, even at that point, the fact that a lot of the disciples had real trouble believing it. If you want to play a complicated psychological game, that the early Christians were masters at deceit and so wove in unhelpful things, you can. I just think that doesn't make sense. There's a certain rough edgedness which is the mark of honest writing. You've got multiple sources which is helpful. You've got disagreements. It's hard to write from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John exactly what happened there, to get. In what exact order does it happen? Which is exactly, as I understand it, what you expect when historians dig up honest sources. What these guys have not done, which they had opportunity to do, was to collude and to get together and to make sure they all were on song, as it were. But they're united. Sometimes the very things that Christianity gets mocked for are actually, I think, its strengths if you understand history. Many of you will understand this. So, we've got no idea where Jesus' tomb was. You can go to Jerusalem, pay your money, and go to either one of two. Although, I think one of them you don't have to pay for. That's the one I went to, the one that was free. But because I'm convinced the other one's false, although it's prettier. The guy who worked that one out thought that the walls of Jerusalem that it speaks of, Jesus being crucified outside, were the present walls of Jerusalem. But the present walls of Jerusalem were built in about the 1500s. So, that's another story. Say, you see how dopey a Christian is? You don't even know where he's buried. That's actually one of the things that points to the resurrection. Because the early Christians didn't give a fig where he was buried. I don't know in what room my daughters were born in King George V Hospital that is now shut down. I mean, it was a very significant thing that happened there, but it was only there for a day. I can take exactly to where my dad's buried, where my grandma's buried, etc. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know certain things, but if it's just a visit. The Gospels don't tell us the resurrection. I think often we miss this. The two most important events in Christianity, the absolute core events, death of Jesus, resurrection of Jesus, there's no description of the resurrection. This is an extraordinary omission. There is, if you want to go and read the Gospel of Peter, which everyone knows was not written by Peter, written 100 and something years after the other four Gospels. He'll give you a really interesting description of who's outside the tomb, because it wasn't only a bunch of Roman soldiers, it was the Jewish leadership and all sorts of people were out there watching. And they'll give you a description of angels coming down and bringing Jesus out, the angels' heads reaching up to the heavens, the guy they brought out between them, he's reaching above the heavens, the cross comes out behind them as well, voice comes from the heavens and says to the cross, "Have you preached to the souls of those who are dead?" The cross answers, "Yea, Lord, I have." And it's all the stuff we want, a description. There's nothing. Why not? They didn't know. They just didn't have the information. There's no description of where Peter meets Jesus. Both Paul and Luke tell us that Peter had a meeting with Jesus, and yet there's no description of it. Badly written stories. You've got the absolute preeminence of women, which is a thing when I first read about it decades ago meant very little to me, but now having some understanding of how profound sexism works in cultures, it is extraordinary that in all the Gospels it is women who are the preeminent first witnesses. So the only person across the four Gospels who's at the death, burial, discovery of the empty tomb and appearances is Mary. Mary Magdalene, not Mary the mother of Jesus. That is a nonsense to do that, unless it's true. Unless you think the early Christians were such subtle liars that they lied in a way that would damage the story, except when they get to about the 21st century in Western countries where we at least try to treat women as equals. Right? In those cultures, women were not really allowed to bear testimony. There's a bunch of really strange, the unrecognizedness of Jesus twice. Two of the first people who meet Jesus don't recognize him first. That is such an... I could write much better propaganda than these guys do. They put things into the story which actually become the basis of some of the books written in the last 20 or 30, or the last couple of hundred years, trying to find another explanation. Right? They give you the information if you want to have a go at it. So I want to suggest to you that the evidence, the way these things are written, have all the marks, it seems to me and to many other people, that these are honest records. But we can discuss that. Lastly, there is a choice. I've got, just to finish up, the apostle says it's either a fact or it's fraudulent. Christianity is either... then it is well, some explanation for this explosive Christian movement that changed the world. For him, and the question for us is to work out whether or not we dismiss them as liars, or perhaps is to go reinstall the Christian greeting at Easter, where one Christian meets the other, Christ is risen, and the response is risen, and the indeed it takes us back to when he's risen indeed, in fact. Right? The corpse has stood up and walked out. Do you want to let people ask from the floor, or do you want people to write them down? Just for a change of scenery. And you can ask a question, either one that you personally hold, or just one that you have heard others, another explanation apart from your own. Okay. Okay. Here's a good question. I'll try and be quick enough so people from the floor, that's always a bit more fun. Is the resurrection of Jesus really one of them different from Lazarus or the dry bones in Ezekiel? The dry bones is one of my favourite chapters. You know, that old African-American song, those bones, dry bones. Beautiful, magnificent story, but it's a picture of something happening. It's a great story. One of Ezekiel is clearly not an event. It's a vision. Lazarus is a resuscitation. It's spectacular. He's actually dead longer than Jesus. He's 4 days dead. But he is brought back to ordinary human life. One of the intriguing things, and this is another thing I think is fascinating about the resurrection appearances, at one level, touch me and see. You know, a spirit does not have flesh and bones. But at the other level, it's not like ours, and it's not like Jesus' body before he was crucified. Because after the resurrection, Jesus turns and disappears. So in John's Gospel, he turns up twice, I think it is, in a room that is locked. Now, it's just he seems to be able to move himself around in a way that he cannot do or does not do before his crucifixion. The interesting thing is that this is just, nothing is made of it. One of the things I find intriguing about it, no theological point is ever made. So when in the letters of Peter and 1 John, etc., it talks about the resurrection of Jesus, it ties it to our hope, to our future. The Gospels don't. They don't make any theological point, which they should. They simply say, this is what happened. So it's totally different. It's later on in the book of Revelation, Jesus says, I'm the first and the last. I was dead, and behold, I'm alive forevermore. Lazarus could say the first, but not the second. Lo, I'm Lazarus. I was dead, and I'm alive for maybe 20 or 30 years until I kick it off. So they're similar, but different. Who are the enemies to whom Jesus appeared? The two obvious ones that we know of are James and Paul. So James, one of the brothers of Jesus, was amongst those who mocked Jesus in John 7, who the family of Jesus, at first, as you know, they thought he was insane. We'll get to that. But the brothers mocked Jesus and didn't believe. But we're told a number of times that James had an appearance of Jesus. He becomes the clear leader of the early church in Jerusalem. James and Peter were the leaders. This is mentioned by Josephus. Josephus speaks of the death of James, and it's just got this little bracket comment. James, the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, where James is identified by his more famous brother. So James has an appearance of Jesus, becomes a member of the early, a leader of the early church. Paul is the other one, who is clearly an enemy, who both Luke and Paul record the fact, or record the claim that the resurrected and ascended Jesus appeared to Paul. It's different from the other resurrection appearances. Because when Jesus appears to the other disciples, he is resurrected but not had not returned to be with God and pour out the Spirit. So it's similar but different. But he's certainly an enemy. Are you saying that Christianity is a house of cards, and that if one historical fact is scientifically proved false, the whole edifice collapses? Do Jesus' teaching then become without value? Why is there need to find the historical Jesus? Our questions? At the risk of being a pedant, and thank you for not anyone writing me a written correction on prima facie that I've seen here, but at first blush, it can't be scientifically proven or disproved. This is the foolishness of, I just thought I'd have a Richard Dawkins dig so that some of my friends feel at home. This is the silliness of Richard, where he says that, you know, if the resurrection is true, it should be able to be proven scientifically. He doesn't understand his own method. Right? Science deals with the repeatable, right? And the nature of history is it deals with the specific event. History, the power of science is the empirical method, where you observe, hypothesize, experiment, reobserve, and it's got to be done again, and it's got to be able to be done again and again. So you prove it. You want to say it scientifically. If you mean by scientific, logical, careful, skeptical, historico-legal stuff is what you're doing. But yes, I am saying if the resurrection is shown to be false or even foolishly unlikely, I think Christianity does come apart. I've heard people, I've read articles in the Herald about this is the, you know, the sad weakness of Christianity. Because see, most people are happy for Christianity to exist in the realm of myth. Right? That's okay. And that's safe. You can't attack the realm of myth. A lot of religions are myth. So to ask the question of when did Krishna walk around India and have his hundreds of castles full of hundreds of women who he kept sexually happy, and I don't mean that as a mock. I remember asking a Hindu I was chatting with, I said, roughly when did that happen? Just within maybe 100 years. That's a stupid question. It never happened like that. It's mythological. Right? And Christianity, in fact, Peter's very clear in one of his letters. He says, you know, we did not follow cleverly devised myths, but we were eyewitnesses. So the New Testament is quite clear that it understands the category of myth, and it says, it's not us. we're dealing with a touchable, datable piece of work. So yes, it does all, it is disprovable. Do Jesus' teaching become things without value? Oh no, look, if Jesus is shown to be a liar because he hangs his own claim on the resurrection twice, once in Matthew and once in John, he's asked for proof that he is God's son, and both times he points to his resurrection. So he hangs his credibility on the resurrection. The apostles hang his credibility. Their message is he's risen. He might be false and have some good teaching. I mean, I don't believe, for example, that Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Aesop and all these, you know, people who say wise things are divine, but you'd be foolish to say you can't learn anything from them. So no, you can still use it, but it has no authority. So when it tells me to love my enemy, which is a particular teaching I don't particularly like, I know what my enemy needs. He needs my help. He needs a good beating, either verbally, physically, his character assassinated behind his back, and I'm just the man to do it. Why would I not do it? Because the Son of God has told me. If I do it, if I give out justice, God will give me justice. So you can still use Jesus' teaching as some people do. Why is the need to find the historical Jesus so important? I think I've probably answered that. It is the category in which the New Testament works. So if it's to be taken on its own value, it needs, the history matters. Dead people stay dead. Do you have any comments on people who claim visions of heaven? That is, they've died, seen heaven, and come back to life. I'm intrigued by them, but I give no weight to them. I've met people who've had post-death experiences. We sometimes call them near-death, but they were clinically dead, but not biologically dead. That is, their heart and breathing had stopped. And one of them had become a Christian through it. I'm glad they become a Christian. I don't put any weight on their after. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying I've got no way to assess the experience. How can I possibly have access? Where is the evidence for it? It's an in-here experience. Dead people stay dead. Yes, usually. Because Christianity is saying that there is one great exception. One of the silly things that people say is, you know, it can't have happened because we know that dead people stay dead. Well, if you work on that basis, you've got to ignore almost every breakthrough in technology. So man arrived on the moon at some stage. Now, the notion that extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence is a beautiful aphorism. It's just vacuous. It gets said often as if it was said by Moses coming down from the book of Zundi. Well, it's not even David Hume. It's actually Carl Sagan, but it's based on Hume. No, an extraordinary claim just needs good evidence and appropriate evidence. So if I had never seen planes flying and knew nothing about NASA and wasn't in the hall of Sydney High School watching this crackly black and white thing as Neil Armstrong lands on the moon and misquotes the statement he'd made to give, and my mother came home and told me it had happened, I would have believed it, because I knew her to be. I wouldn't believe it. So I'd want to ask her some questions. I was just thinking about this morning, because Betty is clever, truthful, scientific, skeptical. So if Betty had come and said, "Ian, guess what? Today, man landed on the moon." Even if I knew none of the steps along the way, I think I would have believed it. I would have wanted more proof, I think, because of the quality of the testimony. This is my last thing, then I'll sit down. I did make a claim. Should I call it a promise? I'd rather not. The thing I've been working on, this thing about Hume, I'm still unhappy with it. I could have run it off for you. I do apologize for not getting it to you for Easter reading. I will kind of nearly promise to do it by next week. But having failed once, I was working on it again yesterday, and I don't want to be unfair to the guy. But in the end, I think Hume, deliberately, because he's an atheist and doesn't believe in miracles, deliberately makes such a high level of proof for miracles that he knows it can't be met. But we'll look at that perhaps tomorrow. But I think the question is whether or not, when you look at the evidence, whether or not the early Christians were liars, whether or not the evidence is solid, whether or not it's believable. I think the thing is to go back and listen to the witnesses and keep an open mind to whether it's true or false and follow wherever the evidence leads. Thank you, and have a good Easter.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.